am the Director of Player Wellness at the NFL Players Association. I'm glad to see everybody here, and hopefully this is a fruitful and productive conversation.
So first, you know, as the sports world, so here's what we know. We know that sport has historically used its platform to promote social justice. And we want to, and what we know is that over the last few years, there's been even a higher level of that integration. But what we know is there's been a limited conversation, at least globally, that really addresses the mental and emotional toll of social injustice as a whole, and racism more specifically. So we wanted to invite you into this first of a collaborative series, the first conversation in this larger collaborative series, making sure that we are looking at how we address the cost of some of the experiences that particularly Black male athletes have to navigate, and you know, what and if there are some tools and some strategies that we can help impart as they navigate this space. In November, the AMA declared racism a public health issue, and that was followed by the CDC's recognition of some of the disease-related costs associated with racism. So while we always knew that there were these health-related costs of race-related social injustices, there's finally been this public acknowledgement. But what we've seen is that this, you know, our typical social justice efforts, at least within this country, have been only on criminal justice reform and police reform. So today we really want to start expanding that conversation to explore mental health implications. So the goals of this conversation are three-part: to educate members of the Black male athlete ecosystem on the mental health impact of social justice related issues, to provide an opportunity for key stakeholders to really think about and talk about their experiences navigating this space, and then to identify and explore tools and strategies that can be implemented to effectively support Black male athletes at every single level, youth, collegiate, and professional. So with that, we are excited to have you here. We're excited to begin this conversation. And we want to introduce our panelists. As our panelists come up, what we'll do is we'll have a general 45-minute panel discussion, and then that panel discussion will be followed by a 30-minute breakout session. And those breakout sessions will be divided based on roles. So people are mental health providers, administrators, coaches, athletes, staff, and athletic trainers. So with that, I'd like to introduce our esteemed panel. I'm just going to introduce them by name and then have them share a little bit about themselves. So we've got Mr. Troy Vincent, who is the EVP of Football Operations for the National Football League. Got Mr. Demario Davis, New Orleans Saints. Got Mr. Kevin Winston, who also works with the National Football League. We've got Herb Martin, who is the team clinician for the LA Chargers. We've got Mr. Alonzo Jones, who is the associate AD for Arizona State University. And then we have Mr. Kingsley Jonathan, who is a student athlete at Syracuse University. So with that, I'd have panelists please introduce yourselves, share a little bit more about who you are. But as you do that, define social justice as you share with us how you define social justice, particularly as you think about it within the context of being a Black male in this country.
I'll let the distinct gentleman, I'll let Mr. Martin, you want to kick us off?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that, Trey. Thank you very much. I've spent the past 25 years working with the National Football League. I've done also work with the NBA. I am currently the team clinician with the Los Angeles Chargers. And when I think of social justice, I think of equality. I mean, that's my visceral response to it. And I think about equal access to the protections and freedoms that are afforded to me by law. And that's in short.
Mr. Jones, why don't you go?
Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much. Alonzo Jones, I go by AJ. I have the wonderful honor of serving as an associate athletic director at Arizona State University. And my role in that context is the life skills side of the house, but also the holistic look at our student athletes to see how they're doing, to include mental wellness, sense of self, and personal care. When I think of social justice, I think it's the reconciliation of America's articulation of what it wants to be or what it said it was going to be, although that was narrowly male and that was narrowly white men. And America's perpetually trying to catch up to its declaration of its highest self, And we see countless examples where we are failing to do that. So social justice is America doing what it said it was going to do on the onset. Now, America has a complex history. It has brought people here involuntarily, and now it has to contend with that. And generationally, we're making advancement. However, in the 21st century, is marked by the wonderful work of athletes across the board and others. We're beginning to address things in very specific kinds of ways to include police, education, and those kind of things. So that's an element of social justice. However, I hope this push, this motivation, this current that we run in will also put a self-determination in ourselves, where social justice will be a means by which we don't ask people for change, but we hold people accountable for change. So we, through our philanthropy, we can create lobby bodies, and we can create entities that can create consequence for people who fail to do what the right thing is, and they respond to a litigious kind of response. So social justice is America's elevation of what it said it was, and our ability to hold America accountable to what it said it was.
So, DeMario, you got to follow the professor.
That was a lot to unpack, DeMario.
Double D is on you.
Very well said. And y'all, just keep that noise. I'm sorry. I apologize. I think I am first a child of God. Secondly, I'm a husband. Next, I'm a father. I'm entering into my 10th season to the NFL. Have been involved in economic advancement and development and social justice to a standpoint for probably the last 9 years. When I think about social justice, I look at the definition and it really is justice in terms of privileges, opportunities, and wealth distribution. And through symbolic interaction, we've pretty much turned it to mean justice for Black people, because to Alonzo Jones' point, it just hasn't been done, and it should have been done. And so I think as a Black man, I'm attached to this race that has gone on, this marathon of our ancestors passing the baton through generation, that in no way, because of who I am and what I'm attached to, that I could not be a part of social justice in the way that we have defined it today. As a child of God, I can't look at oppression and lack of distribution and privilege and access and move past it. As a Black man, I can't look at my people, be a leader in my community, and not do something about it as a husband to a Black wife. When they're excluded from the conversation as a female and as a Black person, it has its own intersectionality. As a father, building a better world for my children, as an athlete with this tremendous platform to do so much good, too much is given, much is required. So when I think about social justice, there's no way in the context that we live in today that I could not be a part of this conversation in every real way imaginable. So that's why I'm a part of this.
And appreciate you logging in from Istanbul Airport. And so with that, I'm going to kick it to Mr. Jonathan, and then we're going to finish up with Mr. Vincent.
As you mentioned, I'm a Syracuse football player. And what I think about social justice is, this is America's way of asking Black people what they want. It's like, okay, we heard you guys. Or we act like we hear you guys. So what do you want to keep quiet? What do you want for things to keep going the way it is? And that's something that mentality that we have to change. Sorry. I feel like it should be like a way to put a light on everything that's been the troubles that we've been facing and the things that we can do, or we can ask or require people to do to make things better for, like, for Black lives as we live it here in the United States.
Awesome. And you know, and so far we've heard reasons why this is exactly why this is a series, right? We're gonna have more of these conversations. We're gonna finish up with you, Mr. Vincent.
Yep, I'll be real quick. Former student athlete, University of Wisconsin, former professional athlete. Today I work for Inyaka, Roman, and many others that's on the call. When I think of social justice, I just think of the quest to find equity and opportunities for marginalized and discriminated communities. That's my my definition of social justice, or when I think of social justice. It's that quest.
Enough said. All right. And Mr. Winston, we finally got Mr. Winston.
Yeah, Kevin Winston. Spent 24 years in National Football League at the club level. Now I serve as senior consultant for the NFL, the league office in New York. And I work with professional athletes in this capacity. When I think of social justice, I think of a level playing field for a young black boy, black man, being able to have the necessary tools and resources to be able to look within yourself and know that you can dream and inspire to become who you are and not have set limitations on what you can do with your life, and also to be able to enjoy the work that people have put in, and also to be able to take advantage of this movement that's going on, and hopefully not just a moment.
Thank you, Mr. Winston. With that, pass it to Dr. Cargill.
So, I mean, I really appreciate everybody's responses. So I want to just dive right in. Dr. Martin, for Mr. Jones, what are the ways in which you see racism and social injustice as impacting mental health, particularly the mental health of black male athletes with whom you interact?
I mean, the list is innumerous. I mean, I think a lot of times individuals are just afraid and they don't always articulate it, particularly football players. So I think a lot of players wear masks in addition to their helmets. They wear masks that don't allow them to be free. And so what happens is many times the individuals that I end up seeing are really trying to work themselves through that. They're trying to master their relationships with coaches while simultaneously trying to find a way in their relationships at home, with parents, families, and friends. And also this the media. And so I think that athletes are often faced with demands that most people don't have to deal with. And at the same time, they have this sense of invincibility that doesn't allow the vulnerability to address their fundamental needs. And so, frankly, you know, one of the roles that I have is helping them to discern that, to get clarity about that.
Yeah, I would just add, you know, we have a saying here that a student athlete can do anything that a student can do. However, not every student can do what a student athlete can do. So there's this added nuance, and with that opportunity comes an interpretive kind of pressure point. There's also the nuance for just the biological age set of 18 to 22, which is physically centered, and all the things you have to contend with as it relates to that, self-identification, peer relationship, amorous kinds of interests. And so the age set is already kind of just riddled with stress and life navigation. You then couple that with COVID, again, all human beings are navigating that, but not all human beings are dealing with a racialized experience in the United States of America. So that is something that is very poignant. And then there's a gender nuance to that. So when you take black male and then you have them at an athlete kind of level, there's this added element of things that beautiful young men have to contend with. And they deal with that and they function within that in various different ways. They have maturity navigation that they're dealing with. In the case of athletes, there's an element of high familiarity, quasi-fame. They're trying to manage that as well. If they're at a collegiate level, they're a highlight reel away from changing their economic circumstances. And all of that has a certain kind of pressure and a kind of buildup to it. Then you assert into the landscape racialized visual murder of black bodies. And what does that do to your psychology? What does that do to your sense of self? And as the brother talked about DeMario, that he feels a kinship, a connectedness to culture. And so with this cultural glue, this connectedness, and you see all this racialized trauma in the environment, it hits you. And a lot of men won't express that outwardly, we'll go inward psychologically, and we have multiple implosions, silent implosions that we contend with. Perhaps we don't contend with it, or we deal with it in other ways that may not be beneficial to us, you know, substance use, we hit the herb, we find escape in sex, you know, we kind of hyper-masculize ourselves at times. And so there's a lot that's going on, perhaps more so or in a different way than previous generations. Yeah, and that stuff can be very stressful.
Thank you for that thoughtful, very thoughtful response. So DeMario and and Kingsley. So what are some of the big and small ways that social injustices of the larger world show up on the field or in the locker room?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think, we all need to understand just how interconnected we are with racism and mental health. I may attempt a bit of a paradigm shift in understanding. We often look at racism as who's the aggressor and who's the victim. When we think about how we got to this point, it's so many generations before us. The reason why it continues to exist is because we're all victims of racism. No matter where you're from, we're all a victim of how it has affected us psychologically. And so even if you think about how we try to progress and fix these issues, we've made it much more about a heart issue, what's right and what's wrong, instead of about a health issue and what's healthy and what's unhealthy. And so what we have reinforced is a mindset that tells that we're different, you know, and that there is a gap. And there's so many micro reinforcements that remind us of that every day. So no matter how much the NFL talks about, we're all trying to serve and be an example of equity and equality and inspire change in the world. Well, every time a black athlete goes on the field as a player and he looks up and sees an entire white executive office, sees an entire white 32 owner team, what do you think what is being reinforced? You are the players. This is where ownership is. And so that psychological, and what is the same? As the owners walk out, they see they're being reinforced with an idea that this is what ownership looks like. This is what the players look like. And it continues, 78% African-American. So we're all victims. So we try to come together. Our minds are in a place where our subconscious has already been conditioned. So no matter what information new that we are learning, until we reprogram our subconscious minds, we will be a long ways away from working together. And that's not just in the NFL, that's in society at large. And so that's what I want us to do, is kind of think about in a paradigm shift that we are all victims of what happened amongst all of our ancestors and how we got to this point. But if we want to move towards progress, I think we need to move away from a heart issue and what's right versus wrong. We all wrong to a degree, we all sinners, but move it towards a health issue and understand we need be a stick. Well, so when we start to think about it, we're all on that same boat of unhealthiness. I think we can move.
Yeah, that's definitely right. I would say, like, since the past year, everybody had this experience. Like, we've had a lot of organization institutions bring up that conversation about what is actually going on. Before that, never heard about it before. It never came up in the locker room because you was just supposed to, anytime you're in the locker room, it's okay. Everything's fine. Everything is in the locker room, it's okay. When you go outside, you worry about what's going on outside. But this past year has forced us to start something as little as that conversation with each other. The Zoom call, everybody comes in and talk about what's going on, how they feel, how people don't realize what's going on. And those little things and some big things that the NCAA is letting us put words and phrases in the back of our jerseys. And we're really doing it because they let us do it. That's one thing that I'm not going to get into. But those are the things that we see that's changed in the past year. Prior to that, you don't notice it in the locker room. It's a different place. It's a sacred place. It's where you don't talk about the troubles of the outside world. And that's something that needs to change. I have teammates that don't even know where a therapist is in the institution. Like, okay, you need to talk to somebody, but you don't know where to go to. So those are some of the changes that we need to keep working on as we go on.
Hey, Amber, can I share a point here?
Absolutely. I was coming to you next, so go for it.
What Dr. Martin had mentioned about the mask. So I was one of those individuals that wore masks, but I was taught the mask. And I was taught that by men that looked like me, that raised me from the community of suppressing anytime I wanted to show emotion. I was considered a punk. First time on the football field, didn't make the right tackle with the youth football coach. He told me that I was tackling like a faggot. And I just use all of those things because there's been multiple generations that we were taught to suppress, to come home and tell my mom that I wasn't feeling well. My mom knocked my teeth out of my mouth. Like, what the hell are you talking about? You don't feel good. deal with it. So there were generations of many of us that have grown up taught that. But now when I look at the new generation, the young people today, where it's okay to talk about it. I never heard of the word mental health until I was in college. Never heard of behavioral health until I was in college. So to see the young people today, and you all are in charge of this, talk about wellness, talk about a holistic approach. We're at a different time in a different place, and all of these things are intersection. But I wanted to mention that because when I heard Doc talk about these masks, well, we got, you know, generations of men who have grew up in that mask, protecting it, and you cannot express that in the sport because the sport didn't allow you to have that, bring that into the locker room or on the field. You had to guard your heart.
Yeah. I think it's really important. You made a really important point. And I think one of the things that, you know, I like to remind people of is that this isn't something that we fix overnight, right? This is something that's been ingrained in us since the womb, essentially, if you really want to think about it, how our mothers might protect us in the womb, or, you know, it's so embedded in who we are that to dismantle it, it takes a lot of work and takes a lot of commitment. So I appreciate that that comment. So I was gonna just kind of ask in general, Troy, what your thoughts are about how this might differ from athletes who are not Black, and how, you know, we can't sort of look at one group and generalize to the general population, and that the Black male athlete population is such a unique group.
They don't know what they don't know. And that's the reality. As a former athlete and now a parent raising my boys, oftentimes a Black athlete, he's alone. And then oftentimes when our teammate wants to help us, who may not be Black, or a coach who may not be Black, the first thing we say, man, you don't know. You don't understand because you're not living the reality that I'm, you know, that we're living, or the experiences that we're living. So we have two different worlds, that the athlete, and frankly here in the corporate setting, that we live. And there's almost a mask and a form of protection that you have to have, not only in the locker room, but those same things exist here on a daily basis in the office, in the corporate setting.
I just want to add to that, Troy. I mean, what we're talking about essentially is survival. And that, I mean, we're talking about 400 years of the same kind of behavior that has been passed down generationally that you talked about, Amber. And so the challenge is really unraveling that and also educating people at the same time, but there is inherent risk in doing so. So for me, the question is, how do I empower young men to share that information? But it first starts with trust and also having organizations, as you alluded to, Troy, that create or allow, if you will, the opportunity for it. This is one step towards that, but also within our own specific respective organizations, what are the costs associated with stepping out? What happens if I take my mask off and go to the general manager or the owner and say, hey man, look, you know, it would be important to have these meetings given the fact that this is going on. And believe me, I've had that conversation, but it was not without a great deal of trepidation and concern, both at the time that I did it and also later. It's something that I carry. And so, you know, the ability to even have this conversation, I think, facilitates the not only the desire, but the empowerment that is necessary for us to impart that to the athletes that we work with.
Absolutely. And so, Kevin, I wanted to see if you had any thoughts about that as well.
Yeah, I would just say that, just to go with Herb, also just where you look at not just the athlete, but you look at management, you look at the coaches, you look at the support staff. You know, we're all trying to support these athletes in this space. And it is to that point of how do I step out? What are the consequences? How do I begin to continue something that's very passionate? And when you look at the athlete, professional athlete, it's not just his teammates. It's also the expectation of what he should do on that pedestal. And I think sometimes it's really challenging. And the way it's been, this is not a national issue now, it's a global issue.
Absolutely. Right?
And so the way our young players stand up and speak and what they say and what they don't say And I personally had to be in the middle of conversations between teammates, because it's one thing to speak in the team meeting room where you have 60-something players and you only have two players really speaking. But then there are sub-conversations that continue to go on in the locker room, in the cafeteria, after practice. And you get that feeling of, from athletes, if I don't say something, how's my teammate looking at me? And he's looking at me not just from a standpoint of this, but also on the field. Am I really in, or am I really all the way in? So I think that it's always a challenge for the guys, but I think we're in a great space. I think, as Troy alluded to be able to see the young men coming up in high school and college, being able to step out and share and have that platform to do so without any consequence, I think is fantastic, and we're going in the right direction. But there's still a lot of work to be done.
No question.
Thanks, Kevin.
Amber, before you move on, I know we pressed on time, but just something for the young folks and the administrators here. Today, the culture is set up, you address these issues after an event. This has to become part of the culture and the DNA.
Absolutely.
Very easy after George Floyd was murdered, after Breonna Taylor was murdered, and after Ahmaud Arbery was murdered, to now have group discussions. And let's talk about this as an HR and how's this affecting people. But those are always event-driven. It's always been that way. And remember, the institutions are set up, whether at the collegiate level or here at the corporate level. It's to manage you. The people that they put in front of you are is to manage where they believe you're going to get in trouble or where the risk may lie. That hasn't changed. So I'm going to bring, rather than bringing people in front of the student athlete for his total well-being on how he may grow. And I think that's the responsibility everyone that's here on the Zoom. But you all as athletes, you have to take that and own it, that it can't be event-driven.
Definitely.
So Troy, thanks for sharing that. And I think I'm going to piggyback on what you guys have really already talked about, right? So we know there's a lot of research that really, has proven that connection between discrimination and social injustice and mental health. And we think about how experiences on campuses or within organizations might be re-traumatizing. So there are a couple of things. I want her, can you speak a little bit to, how do we know when, what we realize is that a lot of times we don't necessarily recognize some of those signs and symptoms, especially when they creep up on us subtly, right? And so we think about how microaggressions over time can peel away at us. One of the things I want you to speak to a little bit, Herb, is what are some of, Dr. Martin, what are some of the signs and symptoms subtly that we might recognize either in ourselves or in others as they're starting to struggle with some of the mental health impacts of that external, some of those social injustices. And then I'm gonna go to DeMario and Kingsley to talk a little bit about sort of your role in this space as well.
I can speak about it both in terms of my own experience and also players. And one of the things that I begin to notice is agitation, even my own sensitivity to criticisms or judgments or what have you, and just really being able to separate myself from that. But what I noticed very clearly is that in film, for example, players will be not attentive, or they're, someone will bring that to my attention, or a player will bring it to my attention. Not being able to focus or sustain their ability to not only focus, but also to perform well, consistently. So if there's a rapid deviation from one's typical behavior to disengagement in film, disengagement with coaches, responding to criticism in very different kinds of ways, it may be an indication that something is going on. And so those are some kind of subtle indicators. More expressed indicators are when players sometimes are getting in fights routinely, that didn't do that before. They're getting in fights in practice, they're getting fights on the field. They're coming to my office and saying something like, coaches didn't give me a fair chance, blah, blah, blah. But, it's externalized because of the fear that they experience in the world, which is definitely a part of their experience on a daily basis. So really unraveling that is really important. But I think for the people that are not clinicians on the line, I think it's important to not diagnose that, but to recognize that as potential indicator that something could be wrong. And it might be a suggestion The suggestion might be to make that referral or to talk to the person in such a way that you provide support and at the same time, you know, encourage the person to use, you know, the resources that are available.
And I think, and not pathologizing. I think that that's the other piece, right? Absolutely. Especially when we think about mental health and again, some of the social constraints and the structural constraints around mental health, not pathologizing. I think that there's a historical context of pathologizing, particularly Black men, right? And so, you know, part of that is getting away from that as well. I'm going to go to the athletes. And as you hear Dr. Martin talk about what some of those mental health impacts are, I'm going to ask, you know, one, you guys have both spoken out and used your platform for social justice. And I think that there is this idea that, again, you know, that you know, you should stick to sports or stick to to shut up and dribble or shut up and play. I am curious, and please share with us, how have you figured out how to manage emotionally some of the costs that you've had to carry, some of that emotional toll of some of the experiences that you've had personally as it relates to discrimination and race and your own mental health? What are some of the things that you've been able to do? And we can start with you, Demaria. I know you're on a clock, so.
Yeah, I think for me, looking out myself is how I learn. I learned, number one, there's no way that I would ever understand the plight of a woman. And even more so, I learned this year, there's no way I would ever fully understand the plight of a Black woman, right? There are so many, we're getting ideologies and reinforcements today that do way more to us than what happens to us necessarily directly. And so in learning this year, doing our Black Woman campaign, that there are so many microaggressions that happen every day, that reminding them that they're a woman, that they're a Black woman. Microaggressions every day that remind that you're a Black man and that it means something, it's supposed to mean something negative. Right. And so, like, that's doing more to me. Like, we just talked about George Floyd that made the whole world stop. Well, look how many Black deaths there have been since George Floyd at the hands of police officers. Right. Reminding us that Black lives essentially don't matter. And look at the storm of the Capitol. That's another reminder, like, you're going to be treated differently based on your skin color. Like, all these little microaggressions, microcosms that really speak to us in a way that if you're not able to catch that and take that thought captive and shift it, that, you know, that this is something that's external but doesn't have to impact me internally in a way that, so it's like, I'm a big person that life is 10% what happens to you, 90% how you respond to it. And so if we don't become conscious to catch those things, understanding that it's a lot more happening to me than what's happening to me directly, when I feel those frustrations, I feel those emotions, I understand it's coming from a sick world. It's not coming from me that I'm sick. I'm viewing this the right way. I'm viewing this in a healthy way. And it's almost to what Brother Alonzo said earlier. It's not going to be, I know I'm viewing this in a healthy way. It's the world that's operating in an unhealthy way. So I'm not going to ask the world to change. I'm going to set that precedent. I'm going to be the change. I'm going to hold the world accountable when it does the change, because it's ultimately unhealthy for me and it's unhealthy for everyone around me. And I think that's what it means in being an agent of change. It's not asking for change. It's demanding it and holding the world accountable if it doesn't change, because it's going to be to the detriment of yourself and everyone around you.
Thanks, Mario. And so, and Kingsley, what are some of the things that you have been able to do to kind of make sure that you're taking care of yourself and managing this challenge in a healthy way?
As Demario mentioned, me personally, I find solace in, like, being able to not just ignore the problem, but try to be a part of the solution. It's very easy to, okay, this happened, okay, change the news station or change, watch something else, think about something else. And it's still in the back of your mind, okay, this really happened. What if it was me? I just had an encounter with the police. What if that was me? Could have been easily me. So it's very easy for us to just change the channel and just not think about it. For me, I try with the help of as many people as I can around me to spark a change, to start doing something differently. That's how I cope. If I sit down and I ignore it, it'll eat me up, and I'll be so angry with myself and people around me that I wouldn't know what to do with myself. And the way I take care of that anger, the way I not have that anger is to try to do something, little things, even mentorship programs that we're doing with little kids in Syracuse inner cities. Think little things that don't seem like a lot, but in the big picture makes a big change.
So action is taking action and regardless of how small. So the last question I'll ask you is as an athlete and on a campus, what are some of the things that you want to see the organization do to improve things in this area, particularly for young Black men on most campuses?
That's some of the conversations, some of the things that we've started talking about this past year. First of all, we need more awareness, like what we're having now, that mental health is equally an important aspect of this social injustice. And tell athletes that it's okay to talk to somebody. It's okay to not be a macho football player every day, every night, and not just keep your feelings bottled up. And that's one of the biggest stressors, I feel like. They're just not going to talk to anybody because I'm supposed to be tough. I'm not going to say anything. Like how Troy mentioned earlier, I'm not supposed to like show that, okay, I'm weak and I'm thinking about something like that. That is the biggest part because, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of football players don't know where the where you can get psych help in some other schools, and that's some of the highlight you need to bring in, that okay, it's okay to go out there and like sit down with somebody and have that discussion and process your feelings and things like that.
Awesome.
So to follow up with that, Alonzo and Kevin, can you really speak to what you feel like the organization's responsibility is in addressing the issue? And the issue meaning the intersection of social justice and mental health, particularly on Black male athletes.
I'll go ahead and go. Well, related to the social justice piece, I think your leadership ought to lead, meaning make an internal decision as to whether or not they support an indifference to it, or they want to join the movement to really impact it in a constructive way. And lead has action, lead has rhetoric, lead has symbols, lead has declarative kinds of statements, lead changes your policy, changes your goal, your strategic plan, and you do it in ways that says, hey, we're going to come out of this different than where we were before all of this sort of galvanized. And so administrators, you got to lead. You got to make a statement. Express your personal sense of self as it relates to this issue of race, and then set that tone. And if you really with it, if you really, really with it, put a certain kind of heat on your collective staff that they need to think about this. You know, the one thing about whiteness is you can choose or you can sort of move in and out of whether or not you want to really wrestle with this thing. But the nuance of melanin doesn't necessarily allow for that when you feel a kinship with a collective people. So this is an opportunity to lead, whether you're white, Black, Latino, male, transgender, whatever the case may be, lead when it comes to social justice. When it comes to mental health, you got to have mental health avenues and outlets all up and down your building. If you know there's certain communities that are in stress, tension right now, your counselors ought to be in the building, meaning they're there, they have office hours, they sit in on staff meetings, they just have a certain visibility. It can be a drop-in, how you doing? Or it could be a session. It could be done intimately in the space. And if that is a concern, then, you know, how do you go outward, right? You also need to have regular touch points as an organization. Do you have a CARES function where the people who have the closest proximity to the student athletes know their rhythm, know their patterns, can see things that are not quite where they need to be, and they can tell someone. And they can tell a counselor, they can tell a medical doc, an athletic trainer, someone who can respond and move it up the chain. And then finally, does your department, not just your sport, but does your department have a CARES function where counselors are around the table, medical team, your sport administrators, and you can assess and evaluate everyone, every athlete in your program. You notice something, what's the issue? More importantly, what's the plan? And how are we following up on it? And are we evaluating it periodically? Presence, collective assessment, follow-up, action, and leadership.
Yeah, AJ kind of said it from the collegiate standpoint. I think from a pro standpoint and what we're doing at the league, I think it is about action, but I think it's more than just about money. I think it's about continual resources that's being provided for not just the athletes, but for the entire organization. It has to be a movement in the community. It can't be individualized to just the athlete itself. We all have to take this step to be able to kind of move forward. I think on the mental health standpoint, we are getting better. We still need to make sure that we provide more clinician time that's mandated by the club, as opposed to it being sometimes optional, to have them on site as much as possible so the guys can have that ability to have that resource. And hopefully we'll be able to continue to develop the trust and the confidentiality and the ability to have these conversations out front and open to be able to make change.
Thanks, Kevin. And so to Troy, you know, I know that there's been a lot more efforts to be inclusive of the HBCU community. So can you talk about what unique needs this group of athletes has and what coaches and administrators can do to advocate for this population?
One of the things I just learned in just my evaluations, complete different world. The predominantly white institutions and HBCUs, as I've done my assessment over the last decade, they just lack complete resources. You know, they don't have clinicians on campus. And in some institutions, they don't know where they are in the local community. So there is, I've found that there's no support in this particular area. And I've actually learned more with some of our legends there now, coaching out of Tennessee State and Deion at Jackson State, just some of the things I've learned at Morgan State where, you know, we talk and they said there's no tie-in, the resources aren't available, there is no community of care. There is no, you know, the holistic approach of wrapping, that the wraparound system is, as Dr. Jones just referenced. That's not even in the minds of the administrators. It's robbing Peter to pay Paul. Kids don't have sneakers, let alone computers to compete. So this is something that, this is our responsibility. This is our issue. Forget a pipeline to the pros. These men and women are affected when these wraparound services are not in place for just their mental state of being as humans. So we got a lot of work to do there. And this is where we as a professional organization, hey, football and basketball, the two dominant sports mostly on campus, we drive revenues. We need to take a look on how we best support in working with the NC2A. The NC2A can't turn a blind eye to this is happening at those institutions where they're under-resourced. And it's tragedy on campus.
For that, I know we have a contingency of folks from HBCUs on the call, and so I wanted to make sure that, you know, we were being inclusive and making sure that their voices and their concerns were also heard, and we appreciate, you know, certainly appreciate the efforts that the league is making to outreach to that community as well.
Amber, can I add one thing real quick?
Yeah, sure thing.
I have found that if you provide an intimate space for men to talk, they will talk. At some point, they may reveal some things that will transcend the facilitator's expertise, so there has to be a handoff kind of nuance. But any one of us in this box can participate in something, what I call ciphers, where you bring an intimate number of men together, you ask them to introduce themselves and to disclose a little bit, set the stage, and then you ask them to submit anonymous questions. No one knows what the question was, who wrote the question. And you put it into a little receptacle, and then you pull it out. And then anyone reads it, and they get the first response. When anonymity is in place, and the circle is intimate enough, and disclosure is established, you'll be amazed at the depth of question and the kind of depth of response. That is sort of cathartic unto itself. It's healing, right? And it gets men talking, and it's in this space of mental connect, but it then also can reveal some deeper kind of things that could then prompt some kind of follow-up. But it's also within our realm, any one of us, to pull young men together just to get them talking and thinking, which is an important part of black male growth.
And Mr. Jones, I think, you know, you hit on something that's really powerful, is that if you can create a safe space, they will talk.
Oh yeah.
Right? Okay. So before we get into the breakout sessions, I'm gonna send out a question to everyone that I wanna hear. Just a short burst. What makes you hopeful about the future? I don't want to end on a on a down note, like we've talked a lot about sort of some of the challenges, some of the struggles that we see, and the fact that we're having this conversation, I think, and starting this dialogue, I think is powerful. So what's one thing that makes you hopeful as you think about the future and you think about some of the positive changes that you've seen? And I'm going to start with Mr. Winston.
I think it's this call. I think it's all the folks who take time now, who are committed to creating the environment, the space, and the design of what we want it to look like for our athletes and mental health moving forward. So to be able to have the space, to be able to have the experts come in and give us the support, but also for the players to be able to have the platform to be able to share and unmask themselves without fearing any recourse from those within their institutions or organizations.
Excellent. All right. Mr. Jonathan.
I would say my generation and this next generation. My generation, we've been very vocal and active about how we want things to be. And that's something that makes me very, very hopeful for the future and how things could be if we keep on the same path, you know.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. Dr. Martin.
Well, I think that there are a number of things, including what has already been said, but I think for me, the willingness, the recognition, and the position of power that individuals like Troy and both of you, and Amber have taken with respect to creating change and the level of sensitivity and awareness that is necessary to change the narrative of the past as it relates to the National Football League. And I'm sure that there are many others, including my good friend here, Mr. Jones, that have taken the position, that have taken risks in their organization, their respective organizations, to say this is something that we need. And so it does take really, frankly, a village and young people that have also empowered me to even get on this line and to talk very freely. So I think that there's that reciprocal kind of exchange that is allowing for a movement, hopefully.
Awesome. And so Mr. Jones, he teed you up. So we're gonna go with Mr. Jones and then we will end with Mr. Vincent.
I have hope just looking out. You know, we were talking yesterday, kind of thinking ahead of today, but if you look at the level of young people that are involved in this, and what I perceive to be very earnest in own kind of ways, and then if you look at high school, collegiate, and even professional athletes that are refusing to let this thing die down, they're putting a kind of unprecedented pressure on America, both government, corporate, education, the refusal to let this thing die. You know, I saw the thing with the Olympics. That'll be very interesting to me. The sense of agency in the young people has risen, and I could just look out and be very hopeful. The other thing is, because I also understand a little bit about something about history, right? I understand our ancestors' arrival and what they had to manage and navigate through, right? And so I'm very hopeful because I understand where we were. And history gives you sanity because it explains a current moment. If you try to look at a current moment without historical context, you're like, well, what the hell's wrong with people, right? But history gives you a context to understand a current moment. And so where the people are right now, they are carrying the baton of the ancestors and the lived elders, and they're continuing this cultural journey towards continuous progress and uplift of the beautiful family called, called black folk in America, African, whatever the case may be. So I have high hope. I think in many ways they're kicking my generation's butt.
And Mr. Vincent,
I think Doc said it. I mean, I have high hopes. I'm excited. What I saw all over the last year with these young lions, young tigers, if we can get the wisdom of Dr. Jones and this athlete activism, this lion that's not determined, oh no, you might have did that to my uncle. You might have did that to my granddaddy. I'm damned if you're gonna do that to me. And we can get that wisdom and get that fire to meet each other. Oh, but I'm seeing it. I'm seeing it here. Doc, you and Amber, collaboration.
But that wisdom, saying Mr. Jonathan and all these young athletes, y'all got to keep doing what y'all doing. You don't turn it off. You got to keep roaring. Love it. I love it. I see the future. I'm looking at it. I'm listening to it.
So it's the best way to end on a positive note. I love it. And you know, of course, this is one of those conversations that we could have forever. But we also, again, we know this is a time period where people are Zoom fatigued. So what we're going to do now is we're going to transition into the breakout session. So you will be signed. You'll see a sign that says, you know, join a breakout session based on your role. So we have mental health professionals. We've got medical staff. We have administrators. We have athletes. And so you'll see in a couple of minutes, there should be something that pops up that tells you which breakout session to join.
S1, good seeing you.
Good to be seen.
If you are not...
If I'm not seeing you, you're not seeing me. Somebody not here.
Let's see. So if you're not assigned a breakout session, let's see. Folks are not. Hold on a second. Are people able to choose any other? Trying to see something now.
And Amber, Doc, thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Before you send me into the breakouts, thank you for having me.
Thanks for participating. Where'd she go? Are we a group? Can you hear me?
Hey, yeah,
some people put in other, so we're actually working through it right now. We'll get you into a room here shortly.
Oh, okay.
Hey, Daniel, do you know how to reassign somebody?
Yes, who was it?
It's Don Davis. He needs to go to coaches.
Okay, and great. I'll take care of it.
I think he's currently in medical staff.
Gotcha. I'll take care of it. Thanks.
How many groups that are associated with like sport organizations that help athletes?
All of the groups are sort of an ecosystem for athletes.
Said sports organizations. I'm a part of an organization called PAC, which is Parents and Athletes Connection, and we help guide parents and their athlete toward athletic success and making decisions and kind of guidance.
Okay.
But my my profession is finance, but that I didn't come on as a finance professional. I came on as my organization. But okay. either one is fine for me.
Okay. I'm gonna put you as administrator.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, this is Nancy Lake. I'm an administrator at Shaw University for the athletic department.
Okay, I'm going to send you there.
Hey, Justine, I'm here in this room.
Hey.
If there are people who are, it's not clear where they need to go, I can facilitate a group here.
Oh, okay.
And can we tell Dan to stop screen sharing so I can see people's faces? Awesome. So, I think while we, if there are folks that, Justine, if you might still push people to rooms, but while you're in this space, we can just kind of have a dialogue real quick. You know, what are your reactions to what you've heard so far? This is going to be kind of freewheeling on our end, but what are your reactions?
I can go first. This is Annette, and I represent parents of professional athletes because I'm a professional athlete and we're in an organization that supports that. So what I've heard so far has been good, because one thing that's really difficult is getting people to talk about it, and the anonymity and the safe talking space was important to me, because I think it's hard to create that unless you create it properly, so you get the right responses, the right people involved, and you actually can move forward in a very constructive way. So I think that's really important. So that was really a good message that I took away from all that. Any reactions?
No, I'd like to echo what Annette just said. Uh-oh, did I get kicked out?
...faces and are having kind of confusing or challenging dynamics in terms of their culture and identity within the space. I don't think that the institutions that I've worked with have had those conversations about culture and character and dynamics in terms of students of color, in terms of the climate that's within campus. I'm coming from Williamsburg, Virginia, Jamestown, going to Troy University, George Wallace, and now I'm currently at UConn. Those specific dynamics matter in terms of transition to space. And so I think those specific environments are distinctly different in terms of how do they accommodate those students? How do we think about Black maleness? But also the institution itself has not had a conversation about how do we deal with them in a proper way and not also add to a system that the K-12 has kind of provided a preparation for that moment.
You're muted, Roman, you're muted.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for that feedback. And everyone here has a story when you talk about being a student athlete. Troy, Trent, New Jersey to Madison, Wisconsin. You know, Usama, Washington, D.C., now you're middle, you know, Kent State and Eastern Ohio, learning how to deal with those dynamics and learning how to be an adult at the same time. The next question I want to move is what are the barriers that organizations face when you talk about specifically supporting Black male athletes? What are some of the barriers? Another part B to that, well, how do we address these barriers? But what are some of just the honest barriers? And again, this is a safe space for administrators and to have this type of discussion. And jump in, Lonzo or Troy, if you guys want to throw some feedback in. What are the barriers?
Roman, one of the things I've just, from my own personal experience, is culture competency. My peers just lack competency in this particular area. They never had to address it. They live in privilege. And we have to show, as administrators, to be effective in this area, we have to love those who actually hate us as hard. I'm going to repeat that. We have to show so much love and empathy towards those who don't want to have anything to do with why are we spending time here? It has nothing to do with a KPI. This has nothing to do with our business model. So we have to spend more time. It's important that we spend time to educate them to say, if we think we're driving revenues now,
imagine if people were in their right state of mind, they were happy to come here and work. And having a culture that was about winning, that was really about team. But I would just say the culture competency is a true barrier, because that's not something that you get when you're on board. They don't talk to you about that. They talk to you about, hey, you know, DE&I is important to us. Diversity, inclusion is important to us. You know, we want to make sure that we're all inclusive, but we're not living that out.
I think Gordon had wanted to get in.
Sure. Yeah, my statement to that was, I think a difficult thing is, I'm sorry, I'm Gordon Thomas, Assistant Director of Football Operations here at USC. I think an interesting thing about that is making sure the right people in the room when we're designing how we're gonna go at these tasks. So we have student athletes. I mean, a lot of programs, a large part of the team is African American. But when these things happen, you know, over time with the social injustice, it's just making sure the right people are in the room when they're thinking about ways to solve these issues or to bring some sorts of team and community amongst the organization. I think that's a major barrier that I've seen over the last year. And just over time in general, working in the sport.
Perfect. Thank you.
Roland, I'd just like to quickly add that, you know, you got to acknowledge your demographics, right? Sometimes you're trying to be polite in your conversation, but if your football team is 85% black, you have to be able to articulate that. If it's 90 basketball team 90% black, you have to be able to say that, right? Because in saying that, then the next question comes, who am I going to get in front of my predominantly African-American community so that they can have at least an entryway and a sophisticated kind of connection? So whether you're black and you're cautious about hiring too many black folk, hey, you got some things to do. If you're white and you're looking at 85% black populace, you need to hire some folks who represent that particular community. And the last thing I'll say from a mental, perhaps scholarship exercise, people of color in the United States of America are communal, all right? That means that they come from a communal mindset, a communal framework, and a communal way of being in the world. Whiteness moves from an individualistic mindset. So if you're wanting to sort of get a glimpse into the collective people, take some time inwardly and think about what is communalism and how does that play itself out? High value in empathy, high value in relationship, right? And what is individualism, right? High value in economics, high value in outcome, right? And so you're working your own mind, right? And the more you get sophisticated with this, regardless of your race or gender, when you speak, they'll get the student in front of you will be able to pick up where your heart is. But to not be rooted in some sense of understanding, rooted in empathy, dealing with young people of color, you're missing the mark.
Roman, let me add on to that.
Sure.
This is important, at least and I think it holds true for you at your institutions, because you have multiple audiences there. Dr. Jones referenced, look at your locker room. My colleagues say, look at the 90 that's filling up that stadium and that's occupying that suite. So it becomes that balance of who am I master to? And we have to find that right integration or mix when we're having this discussion on why it's important and how do we engage. I just wanted to add on that because that's we face that of who's the audience. Because we say, hey, no, the 1,800 guys, hey, 80% are African-American, black, colored, whatever you want to call it. And then you ask about the fan base, who was plus 65 years of age,
right,
white, who's paying the bills. It becomes a, you know, where's the balance? So I just, you know, and having young people, I think George references who's at the table. When we bring in our young employees into the group with that senior staff, they're so angry. They're so angry, and sometimes they don't have an opportunity. That's for us to guide and teach. How do you have this conversation with the commissioner, the chief diversity officer, the CFO? Because right now, you're 4, you're 25, you're 27, and you're so outraged. But they're actually looking at, they're wanting to know, okay, give us solutions.
what are two or three possible solutions? So we got to keep teaching the young people so when they have the opportunity in the room, it's not personal.
Yeah.
That they're informing the audience.
Got
just
it.
Thought, again, just to throw out there as we, you know, we kind of put our arms around the young folks.
Yeah. And I know that, thank you for that comment, Troy. And I know that sometimes the way that our business is set up, college, pro, what have you, you know, your major sports, it's a, if you don't get it done, we'll find somebody else. And you have a short period of time, right? Freshmen coming in, seniors are leaving. Rookies are getting drafted. Guys are transitioning out of the game in any sport. So now we're going to talk about establishing trust and some positives. I know there's some a lot of ladies on here don't like to show their camera, and I don't care what your living room looks like or your background, but whatever you want to contribute, just gaining trust with the student athlete and talk about some solutions. Can we talk about one or two things? I know we got about 6 minutes here. Talk about one or two things that have been successful that you've seen as a model when you talk about hoping for the future a positive result.
Hey, Roman, I'd like to jump in here first. Michael Scott.
Sure.
And I just want to echo some things and add something to the conversation as well. As I was listening to and you mentioned the part about the barriers, you know, one of the first questions that I come up with is how soon do we start this conversation? You know, we're looking at it now from the perspective of college athletes, professional athletes, but can we start this conversation prior to that? Is that something that can be considered? You know, I have a parent advocacy group, Parents Coaching Parents Network, and I try to share as much as what I learned over the years with the parents that I come in contact with to get conversations like this right here started now. Because I have a professional athlete. And what I've learned over the years, you know, if he don't understand what we're talking about now, you know, when should I have started that conversation with him? So that's one thing I wanted to throw out there with the group, to the group.
Hi, my name is Camelia Lanier. I work in academic services. And one of the things that I have found, because I work with football, all football, so that's predominantly a black sport, predominantly black student athletes, is for me, since I work at PWI, is representation. I look like them. I remind them of someone they know. And on our campus, there may be two people in charge. Our head football coach is black. Our AD is black. And we have one black softball coach. And everybody that else is an assistant coach. There's actually only two black professors. And the rest is the help, in other words. So one thing that I've learned to help gain their big part of gaining their trust is I'm very honest with them about where they are. And I look like them. They automatically connect to me because if we have nothing else in common, I'm a former athlete, and then I look like them. And I think the biggest part that a lot of institutions struggle with is you bring these black students to your university and nobody looks like them. And then you want them to change. And then the whole time they're at your university, they're code switching. And then when they have a mental breakdown, then you recruit over them. And they don't understand it because you hyped them up out of high school because you wanted them at that moment. But then you brought them there and gave them no level of support. And then when they spiral down, we replace them. So basically you threw them away. So basically what society has already done to them, you just did it in advance. But this time you messed with them mentally because all their life, someone has told them this is what they were good at. Like I had a student, students have opened to me about it. And I've had male athletes that have talked to me about being great. Back home. And so when you build that relationship with them, they will, if you give them a safe space, I think someone said earlier, they will tell you everything. Almost sometimes like you kind of got to be ready to talk about whatever they're ready for. But if you don't provide people representation at these universities, because we're sending our kids to these PWIs over HBCU. So if we're going to do that, you're going to have to provide representation for them and a level of support while they're there. So the whole time they're not code switching and trying to pretend to fit into this organization that the white man that they're going to school with never has to change who he is, never has to question can he wear his braids in his hair, never have to question if I take a knee during a national anthem, is this going to have a bias between me and my coach? I know At my institution, we conveniently play the national anthem while they're still in the locker room. So we really don't give our players opportunity to have a stand on justice. So that's where I feel like if you're talking about something to be hopeful for, I feel like we more Black people can get in opportunities and positions to represent each other. Then I feel like if each one reach one, we can go far. That's my level of performance.
Can I add a second point to Camilla's point? I think
we got 40 seconds before they cut it.
I'll knock this out quick.
No problem.
You said an excellent point. The reality is that when individuals come to the campus and look for representation, it's not that it's not any, it's minimal. And so then the conversation goes back into the practitioners and the administrators, because there's one person there to try to answer the question. And the administration is pushing a lot of those issues on one person and not having that specific representation. And so the conversation about mental health is also about how we think about the athlete and how we think about institutional dynamics in terms of how do we support our employees.
Perfect. Thank you all. I think they're kicking us out in 60 seconds. Now we got 60 seconds. So thank you guys again, and thank you for the thoughtful commentary. Still a lot of work to be done, but we have to start those critical conversations. And so Troy, Lonzo, everyone, Scotty, Mike, everyone that contributed, anyone that listened in, soaked it in, Usama, thank you guys all. And we'll definitely, I'm gonna report some of this stuff back to the group in the big room. So see you guys on the next side. Thank you again.
DJ, give me a call when you get a chance.
You got it, Doctor.
So we are going to give it a minute to make sure everybody gets back in, and then I will have folks the facility.
You're muted, Amber.
You put yourself on mute.
They muted you.
Somebody muted me. You'll give people a minute or so to get back into the room, and then I'll ask the facilitators of each of the breakout sessions to report out what they heard. We'll get one more minute. So Roman, I'm going to come to you first. You had a group of administrators. Can you talk through what you all talked about and some key takeaways?
Yeah, sure. I'm going through my chicken scratch right now, but I think the broader discussion was just that we were just talking from an administrative and organizational standpoint. Leadership starts at the top, as we all know that, and then organizations have to really prioritize. And given social justice, mental health, you start the prioritization of these issues by having these discussions, including the student athlete, including the teacher, making sure that student athletes are solutions driven. Someone said that you have to have a transformative relationship in a transactional business. When you talk about athletes are coming in every year, student athletes, freshmen out of high school, and then seniors are leaving. Kids are getting drafted every year, are getting drafted every year, and then players are leaving and transitioning into the real world. So. And in those conversations, you have to have one key thought was cultural competency and cultural sensitivity was important. And just acknowledging your demographic. I think Alonzo said that. Just acknowledging your demographic, having that cultural competency and sensitivity. And just communal mindset versus individual mindset. I think some cultures, when you talk about Black athletes, are communal mindset based. And then a lot of white athletes or non-Black or individual mindset. So having to learn that and having to code switch and all that while you're trying to grow up in a locker room or in a college football environment, a pro football environment, and always having to adjust when everyone doesn't really adjust to you. And then the next one was just continue to just have those conversations. The last question was, what are some of the successful ways that organizations have done it? When some of the ways that haven't been as successful, we didn't really get to that very last one, but it really starts with having those conversations, including everyone, being intentional, a lot of common sense things, but I love the making sure that you're cultural sensitive and cultural aware of the demographics that you're dealing with.
Awesome, thank you. Don Davis, Dr. Don Davis, you're up. What'd you hear from the coaches?
Yeah, we had coaches, and our coaches were discussed about, well, is it the coach's responsibility, right? A lot of times they're the closest person or relationship to those athletes. So many of the folks said was it depends, right? Are you experienced in that? Are you willing to do it? And we came around ultimately to say every person in a position of leadership should make the effort, right? But we talked about some ways in which that's been done well and some ways that it hasn't been done well, right? So when we talk about what barriers are there that could lead someone not to address this issue head on, ignorance, bias, privilege, fear of that you cost of, you know, speaking out could cost you your job, depending upon where you are, particularly if you're in a PWI. And then we talked about even someone mentioned on there about, look, just having the conversation once or doing something once and just making it a one-off isn't good enough, because it seems that it's about creating a space to have continuous conversations. And then our final question, same thing, we didn't get into as much as about this perception of mental health tied to weakness and how and what ways can we, what ways do our actions condone that, right? And what ways can it diminish that? So we didn't quite get there, but we were just talking quickly about authentic self and allowing people to show up the way that they are and providing them the resources that they need.
Thank you. All right, Zamir, you're up next. You had some student athletes.
Yes, there were three key takeaways from our group. The first, when we think of the mental health professional, someone who looks like us and shares our experience seems to be important to our group. And that's more so around the issues that Roman sort of hinted at, cultural awareness, cultural competence, cultural sensitivity. Two, we need to become the someone who looks like us, right? So we need to see ourselves beyond professional athletes. At some point when we make that transition, these very fields, whether it be coaches, GMs, mental health professionals, we need to begin to see ourselves in these spaces, right? So we need to become the someone who looks like us. Yeah. And then third, we would like to see, meaning those athletes in the discussion, mental health be integrated as part of the system or regimen. No different than if you miss a meal, you have that morning run. No different than your weight room being mandatory. No different than class checkers at each of your classes. We need to integrate mental health as part of the model for student athletes, whether that's 4 sessions a semester or 8 sessions a year, however that looks like, it needs to be integrated. And those were our three key takeaways.
Thanks, Amir. Dr. Martin, what did you find out from the mental health professionals?
We'll see, Dr. Martin. Oh, there you go.
You're muted.
Really interesting that it really intersects with a lot of what has been said already, but some of the main takeaways is the importance of remaining authentic and being human, which requires vulnerability. And a number of the clinicians talked about really learning how to listen actively and really become more immersed into the culture and as a vehicle to understand who they're working with, realizing that it is a process, it's not an event. And that process requires a lot of hard work. It requires having difficult conversations, but it is something that is humane. And it is something where humanity is the focal point in establishing real trusting relationships with players, which is certainly at the foundation of any kind of therapeutic intervention. And so I think the group across all three questions really addressed a lot of those kinds of issues. Those were the predominant themes.
Thank you. And then Dr. Driver, you had medical staff. If you're talking—
Yes, I think I'll follow the suit with Dr. Martin and kind of talk about it thematically in the interest of time. I think looking at the questions that we had, they were, what are the ways in which you see racism and social justice impacting general health? How do you address that, both individually and from a system standpoint? And what are some ways in which we've seen it go well and not go well? And I think thematically, what the group really talked about was a combination of, we don't know what we don't know. Right. There isn't kind of identified model by which to kind of screen people and try to engage them in a conversation. Concerns around how is somebody going to react when you try to engage them in a conversation. And I think one of the ways, and it's kind of a highlight, it does seem to kind of help is to provide some context for the questions and the engagement. So the example would be to maybe cite the AMA's position statement on racism, and then have that lead into a conversation around whether or not it affected you, or if somebody's been affected, so that it doesn't become, I think, something as Mario Davis kind of mentioned, kind of an adversarial sort of a conversation, because just almost by definition, we're on what can be, we can, it can be perceived that we're on two different sides.
Thank you. All right. So, I mean, this is, I just want to remind everybody, I was reminding the group that I facilitated, that this is, we anticipate one of several conversations we're going to have over the course of the next few months. And so, what we weren't able to get to today, we certainly want to make sure that we are able to address it in conversations that we have moving forward. I think one of the messages that I heard loud and clear was that this can't be a one-off conversation that we have to kind of continue, and Inyaka and I are committed to, going with that as our marching orders. So, for the panelists who are still around, Dr. Martin, any final thought on or one takeaway to send everybody off with?
Yeah, I think that fundamentally we really have to look at ourselves first. And if we're going to work with Black athletes, we really need to look at what is our relationship to ourselves in relationship to them, and how does that impact our lives? And so, I mean, to me, the takeaway is really about self-awareness and challenging oneself to be fully authentic when working with Black athletes.
Awesome. Alonzo?
First, I want to say thank you guys for letting me spend some time with you all. Very insightful. Conference, Dr. Martin, thank you for the recommendation. The only thing I would add is a part of social justice is a people's capacity to hold other people accountable. Oftentimes, people are afraid for whatever life reasons to take certain kinds of stances. As our athletes become more and more philanthropic minded, meaning they choose to fund their own ideals, I would, and those who have influence on them, I would invite us at times to say, hey, can you create autonomy so there an organization can be created that can mind the environment using statistical disparities by racial lines, examine why that exists, and through legal means begin to address it. There's also people out there with profound ideals. However, they got to pay rent. They got to pay a mortgage, so they keep their mouth closed. How can our philanthropy fund our leaders who are doing things in very creative ways so they can move autonomously without fear of reprisal? Right. So I'm asking those who will one day be at a point to where your great-grandchildren will benefit from your wealth to think how to utilize the remaining wealth to create something with some depth and with some bite to it, that can challenge social justice issues. That is an organization and certain kinds of thinkers who need fiscal autonomy so they can move with a liberated mindset.
Thank you, my brother.
All right, Kingsley, I think you might be the last one of the panelists who's on.
Yeah, I'm gonna try to follow that. I would say for the most part, for the administrators and the coaches, it's just the little things that you do matter that we notice. We notice the little things, like letting it be known that how you feel about certain things. Like when everything happened this past year, some people said some things, some used generic, okay, this is happening. We just want to know that, okay, you understand what's going on. You're listening to us and you're here if we want to talk. Those simple things is all that we need to have in the back of our head.
Awesome. So I'm dropping Inyaka and I's contact information into the chat. If there are any follow-up questions or any thoughts or ideas about what you might like to see with future discussions, we'd be happy to hear that and take that feedback. But I really appreciate everyone's openness on this call. And like I said, you know, this is one of several conversations and we hope that you will be back for later sessions.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care,
everybody. Thank you for putting it together.
Yeah.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for participating.
Great job, everyone.
Thank you, guys.
Good to see you, Dr. Martin.
Good to see you too, man. Yeah. Take care, buddy.
You too.
All right, Doc.
Nice to meet everybody.
All right. See you, Scotty. I'll call you, boy.
All right. Later.
Thank you.
Good to see everybody. Good to see everybody. Dr. Martin. Alonzo.
Yes, sir.
Likewise. Let's stay in touch.
Good to see you, man. See you, Dr. Scott. Be cool.
All right.
All right. I'm trying to read these little chats.
How do we... I'm trying to respond to something.
Take care, Amber. Take care of yourself.
Bye.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you.
Check on it. All right. Bye now.
Thanks, AC. See you soon.
Bye.